David, do you have any closing words?
I just want to wish everybody a happy holiday. As a pagan, I like to see historically how the different things have changed over the centuries, but I like history. So there's lots of different outlets, and we have them all. Join us for some of the things. We are a friendly organization, and we like food.
Thanks, David.
Welcome.
Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.
On January 25th at 8 p.m., the Cinematheque Quebecoise presents Gashrat. Gashrat is Kelly, Tara, Chelsea, and Gabby. Gashrat sets the record straight. Gashrat remembers a lost Montreal. Gashrat is a convergence of spirits deserving each other. Gashrat is a rock band. Gashrat is back for one concert, for one night only. Get your tickets now at cinematheque.qc.ca. Presented by the Cinémathèque Québécoise and CKUT.
Welcome to Older Women Live on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We come to you monthly every second Wednesday of the month. I'm Laura Yaris, your host for this evening, but with us in spirit is the rest of our collective, Brizna Kaharo, Marlene Rateau, and our dear Rosemary Wally, to whom we wish a speedy recovery. Today on Older Women Live, we're going to be following up from an interview that I did 3 years ago with Dr. Paula Rochon, who is the director of an organization that was just starting out at that time called the Women's Age Lab. They've grown considerably since then, with many more staff, grad students, scientists, researchers, and so on. And they have some campaigns, educational campaigns, and they're working with other organizations around the world, and you're going to hear more about that in just a few minutes. For those of you who, 3 years is a long time, so I will give you a little recap here about Dr. Rochon. She is a senior scientist at the Women's College Research Institute in Toronto, and she's the director of the Women's Age Lab. She's also a professor at the Department of Medicine and Institute of Health Policy Management and Evaluation at the University of Toronto. She's a retired Teachers of Ontario Chair in Geriatric Medicine, also at U of T. And she's also widely published, has won many awards, including the Fellow of the Canadian Academy of Health Sciences, a Career Award from the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, Excellence in Leadership, Baycrest Awards and Recognition Committee, and the Dr. John Myers Visiting Professor of Geriatric Medicine at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. I really appreciate that she gave of her time again to explain some of the new campaigns and all the progress that the Women's Age Lab has made over the last 3 years. So I first asked Dr. Rochon, what made her and her colleagues decide to start this organization?
So it started off as this idea, right, that we needed to focus on women and aging. And it just caught on in that, you know, first off, people think it's a great idea. People, every time we talk about it, are so interested in it. They want to hear more, you know, think it's so timely. How can they contribute? All good things in that regard. So we had to and have continued to hone in on a couple of areas of focus. We're looking at issues around how do you promote the social connections to reduce loneliness. You know, a big issue for women where women tend to live longer than men, but as a result of that, they may often be living alone, and people who live alone are more likely to experience loneliness. So a big issue there. And we're also focusing on the idea of reimagining aging in place. People are so interested in what their future is going to look like and where they want to see themselves and where they want to live. And so we've taken that on as well. So those are our major areas to kind of hone in the huge, huge area when you're thinking about older women. And we have a bit of a cross-cutting theme where throughout all of this, we're looking at ways to really address gendered ageism, so discrimination based on sex and age, as something that, you know, something that sort of runs through a lot of the things that we hear about and something that we want to just make sure that we're bringing to people's attention and doing whatever we can to get rid of that.
This term gendered ageism, I see on your website, you have a campaign around this idea. And there's also a toolkit. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about this toolkit and what its purpose is.
Yeah, so we did create a campaign around addressing gendered ageism. Ageism, which is discrimination based on your age. And there's also sexism, which is discrimination based on your sex. And the interesting thing for women is that they experience both as they get older. They experience the ageism side and they experience the discrimination based on their sex. And we call that gendered ageism. And one of the first reasons we did the campaign was to raise awareness of it, because even when people are thinking about it, they just talk about ageism and don't mention the gender component. But it's sort of like a double whammy for women. And so we wanted to make sure that people are thinking about it. And so that if you're thinking about it, you can maybe then start thinking about what are the things you can do to potentially address it.
Can anybody get this toolkit?
Yeah, so that information is on our website. If you want to go there, there's some materials that might be helpful. And I think we've also got some podcasts that we've done related to the topic. as well that people might find interesting. You know, sometimes it's good just to sit down and listen to some of these things.
Have you had some response already? Like, is there a way to know, like, how many organizations or professionals or individuals might have downloaded that toolkit, or how it's being used in general or in medical institutions?
Well, one thing that I think is interesting is that terminology is now one that I think people are starting to use, so the idea of gendered ageism. And the WHO did a really interesting campaign about addressing ageism. And there were some pieces written about it in The Lancet, which is one of the big medical journals. And we responded with a piece about, you know, ageism is really important, but let's also think about gendered ageism and how this may impact women and men differently, but especially the impact on women. And that's now being cited and used by people. So it's starting to get into the lingo a lot more, and what I see is people are now stopping and thinking about and using that terminology, which didn't see so much before.
The other campaign or project that struck me, it's called Prescribing Cascades. From what I read about it, I think that kind of happened with a family member of mine many, many years ago. And at that time, fortunately, it was a little easier in some ways to reach your doctor fast and be squeezed in between two patients. And it was very fortunate in her case, I think, that she had a daughter-in-law who had a bit of a medical background and was able to cart her off to her doctor right away. And the problem got solved quite fast. But maybe we can explain to our listeners, this is a new term also, prescribing cascades. What does it mean, and why do we have to be aware of it and fight against it, and how can we do so?
So I think it's such an important issue because it relates to one of the pieces we're talking about in Women's Age Lab, right? It's about medicines and how do you optimize the medicines and how do you make sure you're on the right medicines for you? Because, you know, we all know medicines are life-saving, right? They're super important. I know occasionally when I've been ill and needed an antibiotic, it just, you know, you go from feeling so sick to all of a sudden you're feeling better. Like, medicines are super important. So we have to remember that. But as a geriatrician, one of the things that I started to recognize years ago, and a colleague and myself wrote about this quite a number of years ago, was that the sequence of events that you don't necessarily want to have happening, but happens, in my view, all too often. So here's how it goes. You know, you go, say, go to your doctor and you have a problem. Like, for example, you might have knee pain and your doctor prescribes you a medicine for your knee pain. One of the things you might get is an NSAID, you know, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, but you can get them over the counter too. You might just go do it yourself. But anyway, say you get the drug. And then weeks, months later, something else happens. So say you go to your doctor and now you've got like stomach upset. Your stomach's just bothering you. You don't feel right. And so you mention this and they say, oh my goodness, you have something going on in your stomach. Why don't we put you on a medicine to treat that? So it might be something we call like a protein pump inhibitor. It's like a drug that you would use. So then now you're on another drug because now you've got a stomach problem. You have the knee problem and the stomach problem. But a prescribing cascade happens because you had this initial problem, you know, with your knee. You got put on a drug. It actually had a side effect, and that side effect was to cause the stomach problem, which right. Instead has been misinterpreted as a new medical condition that better treat. So then now you're on another drug and potentially on the side will experience the side effects from that drug. And the thing is, this happens a lot. You know, when we first started writing about this a number of years ago, we wrote about three cascades, three is, you know, examples of things that we were thinking of that came to mind. And over the years, you know, I've kept seeing more and more in clinical practice or stories, like you said, you had this circumstance in your family or other people have said to me, we have become aware of more. People have been writing about it in the literature, so they've been adding things. We've now identified over 160 prescribing cascades. And we know that the more you think about it, there's many more. So the reason they're a problem is because, you know, number one, being on drugs you don't need to be on and developing more problems and side effects if you don't need to have them. So that's a big one. But it also leads to this idea of polypharmacy. That's another issue. A lot of people are on multiple medications, polypharmacy, often five or more medications. When you're on a lot of medicines, other things happen. You have to remember to take your medicines. You might start getting them mixed up. That becomes a problem for you or sometimes for your family who's trying to keep track of what's happening to these medicines. You have to pay for them in some circumstances, and you know those are expensive. And they just may not be needed at all. So the thing about the prescribing cascade is we're trying to raise awareness about it so that people can ask questions. For example, when you're experiencing a new problem, a new symptom, you need to ask, could this be related to a drug? And is, in fact, a new drug being used to treat a side effect from a drug, you know, that I'm already taking? And so the question would be, is there a safer drug available that I could have taken in the first place? So, for example, going back to the knee problem, was there a different drug rather than an NSAID drug that I could have taken? Or could I have used a lower dose? Sometimes the issues are dose-related, and you, if you need the drug, maybe it's a dose thing. But it could have been, you know, do I need the drug at all? Like, what about physio or something else might have solved the problem? And then it would have saved all this other stuff happening. So it is.
And it's also related to drug interaction.
Yes.
Right? Because if the doctor who prescribes medication number two doesn't know about medication number one and prescribes something that interacts badly with that one, whereas if they knew what the drug was, maybe they could prescribe something different that wouldn't interact in a harmful manner. Like, that's a factor too, I think.
Oh, yes. I think you have to think about that as well. But it just does go back to also, you know, I think we all have a bit of a responsibility about our medicines. And one of the things that I think is really helpful for family and caregivers to do is whenever you get a new drug, it's important to say what the drug is, why it was started, when it was started, like what the date was, and who started it. Because often I see people are on these medications, could be for many years, and people just don't have that information. But if you have that information and you're going to be started on a new drug, you can see a sequence of events. Oh, I was on this one first, then I was on this, and maybe there's a relationship there. But if you don't have that information, it can be difficult to see.
Yeah,
and so it helps people in sorting it out and thinking about what you really do need to be on if you have that kind of information. And I think, you know, families and patients can play a big role in making sure that that information is collected.
Another term I'd like to talk to you about concerns the research gap. I mean, I've heard this before, that a lot of pharmaceuticals, for example, are tested on men and not on women. And that could be detrimental sometimes to women because the drug doesn't affect women in the same way as it affects men. And so there's a term regarding research, disaggregated data. Maybe you could explain what that is and why it's important.
Yeah, so you've raised a whole bunch of things that we pay attention to. So it wasn't until the 1990s, at least in the United States, that women needed to be included in drug trials funded by the federal government. And it wasn't actually until just a couple of years ago that older adults also had to be included in drug trials funded by the federal funding agencies in the United States. So you can imagine, as people get older, they often have more conditions, often using more medications. It's really important that those same people that are using the medicines were tested. And one of the things about not including women is that in some cases, women and older people require lower doses, for example, of a drug to get the benefit. And if the dose is too high, they're more likely to have a side effect. So it's really important to make sure that this happens. And maybe that's related to what we just talked about in terms of gendered ageism, you know, discrimination based on your sex and your age as to why people were not included. Now that's rectified, but it sort of speaks to the kinds of issues that you might see and some of the residual effects. But you asked about sex and age disaggregated data. And that's something that we're really pushing for, because too often when you're talking about anything, you talk about older people, you talk about them as if somebody who's 65 is the same as somebody who's 95 and the women are the same as the men. And we know that there's important differences. You know, if you're running a race, and, you know, they have masters track events that are held all around the world.
Yeah.
They actually have figured it out. They have events for men and they have events for women. And they actually put people in 5-year age groups.
Right.
So
yeah.
They know that you need to kind of adjust. You know, why don't we do that? You know, with a lot of the way we collect data. So what we're encouraging is when you're thinking about anything, if you're thinking about heart disease, if you're thinking about some of the uses of drugs or whatever it is that you're doing, if you collect information based on sex and age groups, you start to see patterns. You know, perhaps it's women who are over the age of 85 who might be having more difficulty with something or might be complaining of something more often or might, you know, there might be a piece that you need to pay attention to. If you just look at everyone the same, you don't learn about women, you don't learn about men, and you're not really helping anybody. And somebody said to me, you know, things like chronic conditions, things like arthritis, things like heart disease, things like that, for the most part, they happen as people get older and you
right.
understand when these things are happening and how they may present differently for women and men. You know, arthritis is more common in women than it is in men. Like, how do you see these differences? We need to make a point of looking for them, or else people don't see them. And if you see the differences, then you can create strategies to try to optimize things for those individuals. So that's kind of the long and the short of why I think sex and age disaggregated data is something we should all be pushing for and think about in everything that we're doing.
Yeah, I think that even goes for different races. I think I remember reading somewhere recently, like sometimes Black people don't react the same way to certain medications or the, you know, this kind of thing, or Asian, whatever, you know, different ethnic groups. They might have sensitivities in some ways or things like that.
That's very true. And, you know, we're talking, you know, they talk about this as being intersections, like the various different pieces that play into it. We're talking about the very bare bones that we're talking about the sex and age disaggregated data as the starting point. But all of these intersections are important, so really timely to start thinking that way.
Thank you.
And that beautiful musical interlude was The Greenwood, a composition by the late, great Kay Gardner from her recording A Rainbow Path, in which all the pieces are related to a color, a note on the scale, and one of the chakras in your body, if you're into yoga. This is the heart chakra. Kay Gardner did a lot of groundbreaking work on music and healing, and ironically, bitterly ironically enough, died of a heart attack at the age of 63 after being sent home from the hospital after she went to the emergency for a backache, and they sent her home. Again, an example of discrimination against women, because often heart attack symptoms manifest differently in women. In case you've just joined us or have perhaps forgotten, let me remind you that you're listening to Older Women Live, 90.3 CKUT. And now we're going to continue with part two of our interview with Dr. Paula Rochon, director of the Women's Age Lab in Toronto.
I'm just curious, too, like, what made you decide to get into the field of geriatrics yourself? What motivated you?
Well, I guess, you know, in my own personal life, I had grandparents that lived long and healthy lives. Actually, my grandfather lived to almost 103, which is quite unusual. And he was very, very healthy and sort of, and my own parents as well were always very healthy. And I guess it made me reflect on what it is, what are the things that they were potentially doing that helped them have health and well-being as they got older? And what are the things that, you know, we could learn from them and other people that might help people more broadly? So I got interested in that. And then also thinking that aging is something that impacts every single one of us. This is something that has to matter to all of us.
Right.
And it's something, you know, our, you know, even just looking right now, aging population is so large. You know, in Canada, we're about to be a super age society. 20% of us will be over the age of 65. But depending on what you call old, which is, you know, lots of definitions, if you take 60, which is what the World Health Organization does, there's now a billion people in that age group, majority being women. So there's just such a huge need and so much to do that I just felt it was something that I became very, very passionate about.
Yeah, well, that's great. That's great. We need more of that. I fall into that category myself, so I'm starting to worry about a lot of stuff and have had dealings with the medical system 3 months after my 60th birthday. So it's on my mind a lot too. So I was excited when I found out about this Women's Age Lab and hope that it's going to make a big difference. I mean, there's a lot of really great people involved, it looks like. And you're also working with other countries, I understand.
Yeah, we have a great team here based at Women's College. So we're really, really fortunate. We have, you know, scientists that are interested in each of these different areas. But, you know, even though we're talking about it here in Canada, this issue, thinking about how do you improve health and well-being with age, is something that matters to everybody around the world. And so it's international. And so, yes, we're able to work with people from different countries. And we're working with people from Ireland and Belgium and Israel and Italy and Canada and the United States, you know, just to name some of the countries that are involved in this work. And it's very interesting when you work with people in different countries, because although there's a lot of similarities, there are differences as well. And you learn from each other. You know, you really, really learn from each other. So it's a fabulous opportunity.
So you're kind of involved in an international network almost.
Yes, it is. It is actually that.
Of like-minded organizations.
Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah. If you sort of find, what is it, you're simpatico, people that think like you do. I think people want to have their health and well-being for as long as they possibly can. I think that's the goal. How do you optimize that?
Do you have ideas of what kind of projects the Women's Age Lab is going to be working on, let's say in 2024 and 2025?
Well, one of the pieces that we've just started working on, which relates to the idea of people wanting to age, reimagining aging and aging in place, is work that we're doing with looking at something that we call naturally occurring retirement communities, or NORCs. This is something that we're very interested in doing or interested in working on. So right now, you know, these NORCs are basically, if you can imagine, an apartment building or a condo often, where there's often many, many people living in the building, but there's a large percentage of people who are older. So maybe it's over the age of 60 or 65 or whatever the age cutoff is. Generally about 30% of that group are in that older age group. So that would be a naturally occurring retirement community. We know that there's more people, older people, living in naturally occurring retirement communities than there are people living in long-term care or retirement homes together. So that's, you know, a large number of people are living in this kind of context. But what we're interested in learning about, and we've got research funding to look at this, is how do we enhance those naturally occurring retirement communities? So, for example, how do we bring in supports or services that they might want to help them age better in their home, which is in an apartment or a condo? And it's about thinking about, part of it is around creating social connections, so opportunities for people to get together in a building. So you can imagine, how often have you heard people say, oh, I'm living in this building, but I don't really know my neighbors. You know, I wish I did.
Yeah.
Well, you could. And so how do we, you know, create, you know, maybe it's coffee times that people can drop in and just, you know, sit for coffee, or maybe it's a book club, or maybe it's a cooking club, or whatever it is that people might want, and who knows what people might want, but, you know, people are pretty clear about what they think would be interesting. Could be a walking group. If you set it up so it's for the building, you know, you're, everyone is welcome, and get people to come, you start to create social connections. You can also do other things that are good for people's health, like getting people more physically active, which might be good. Or, you know, helping people that might be living alone and, you know, maybe just eating for one isn't, you know, necessarily always healthy eating. How do you help people have opportunities maybe to eat together or learn about how do you cook for one or how do you share food or whatever it is that could maybe help nutrition as well? So lots of opportunities. And similarly, people may need some support. Maybe they need some caregiving support, or they may need some help with housekeeping or whatever it is. If people come into the building and those resources can be shared, it's much more efficient than having all sorts of different people come into the building the way services are currently kind of organized. So you have certain people that you know are coming into the building that can help many people in the building. So there's all sorts of things like that that we're looking at in terms of how can we enhance what already occurs, these naturally occurring retirement communities, so that it allows people to have the health and well-being that they want as they get older and to stay in their home for as long as it makes sense for them to do that. And, you know, putting in some of these connections and supports is a way that we think could make a difference. So that's one of the projects we're working on that is very important for older people, but women in particular, because women are more likely to be living alone and may need some of these supports. So we're very excited about that.
It's a really interesting concept. I mean, there's also the concept of, I think I've heard it's called intentional communities. Like, for example, my cousin in the States bought and her husband, they bought a newly built home in a kind of a community that's like for 55 plus, mm-hmm. you know, rather than for young families, you know. And there's other people that I know that live in these they call them gated communities, and it's more for like older retired people. And they have condo buildings or separate homes. And I guess some of these principles that we've been talking about could be applied even in those intentional communities to have different ways of providing medical care and whatever so that people can stay where they are.
Yeah, I think that's very much the case. I think one of the things that I like about the naturally occurring retirement communities is it's also intergenerational. You have older people
yeah.
and younger people, and you have the opportunities to take advantage of that. And, you know, how do you kind of learn from each other, you know, take advantage of that opportunity?
Yeah, it's true. Instead of, like, having to move to a special community, you're already there because
yes.
your neighborhood happened to be like that, or your apartment building or whatever, or your condo building. Yeah, I see your point. Yeah, I mean, I think, again, I don't remember where I read all these things, that it is in a way more healthy to have an intergenerational community rather than have something that's exclusively for older persons. Have you read anything
yes.
about that?
Well, I think to go back to your first question, which was around the idea of how do you, thinking about gendered ageism and how do you address gendered ageism? Well, one of the big pieces they talk about education is one of the pieces and raising awareness, which we discussed. But one of them is intergenerational connections. You know, getting older people and younger people together is a way to address the gendered ageism piece. So it all kind of ties in, comes back together, and, you know, can be sort of very, very beneficial.
I've even heard of things like young students, maybe not high school, but say a university or grad students, and there's maybe an older woman who is a widow and her children are dispersed to different cities and whatever, and they might rent out a room or give one or more students even free room and board. And in exchange, the young student would, or students, as the case may be, would help out with different tasks, physical tasks, and be on hand in case something happens that they'd be able to call for help or things like this.
That's a fabulous idea. It's a great program. I think it's called Home Share. And it's a win-win because an older person may have a lot of space and they may want companionship, and income is also welcome.
Right.
Whereas students often are really looking for places to live, and they can also be very much alone. And so the companionship can be really good for them as well. And, you know, it's potentially a bit more affordable. So I think it's a wonderful pairing.
Yeah, it's also a learning opportunity.
Yes.
For both. The older person can keep up with current trends and current terms and so on, and the younger person can learn a lot from the life experience of the older person.
Very, very true.
Yeah, you know, so that works in that way too. So what do you see in the future? Are we getting better? Because I get discouraged, you know, when I see still so many people, including my own father who passed away last year, and by then it was a blessing, unfortunately. And I found that he was in an institution where he was well cared for in terms of he was clean and regular food, and he got his COVID shots and his flu shots, and he had his room, and the place was clean and so on. But he lost his identity. Like, somehow his hearing aids got misplaced and his glasses got misplaced, you know, and you would see him, and those aren't his clothes. He never dressed like that. He would never wear something like what happened to his clothes? His wife would tell me, I sent all these clothes with another family member, and somehow they disappeared or whatever. And it just very disturbing and very discouraging. But do you see things really improving overall? Do you think, like, say, in 5 years, things are going to have taken a step forward and people aren't going to be in those kinds of situations as much?
Yeah, well, first off, I'm very sorry. I know it's hard when you lose somebody like that. But, you know, I think that's, I guess, one of the reasons we're trying to find ways when people are able to stay in their home, if they can and they want to stay there, we want to try to find ways to do that. And yes, they may need some support. But if they're able to have the things they need and they're able to get the care that they need, then it often makes sense for them to stay in their
right.
home. And so if that's the case, we want to allow people to do that as long as possible. Because I guess what we don't want is somebody who has to move because maybe they're having trouble preparing their meals. It's something that we could do for them. So, you know, you want to think about where that is. And then, of course, you want to think when people are in long-term care or retirement homes, how do you find ways to make sure it's more personal? You know, people are looking at different kinds of models, you know, not to have such a big institutional feel, but thinking about smaller groupings of people, just like sort of more of a family environment. So it is much more personal. And people are thinking about that in a lot of different ways, including what the building looks like, how the care is delivered, all of these different pieces to make it much more sort of, shall we say, person-centered, so that person can be the person that they need to be.
I will like to thank you very much once again for your time. It was nice to see you again. And maybe this time next year we can do this again and see what new projects are happening and some of the outcomes of these things that we've just talked about, the gendered ageism campaign and the information about the prescribing cascades and so on, like what kind of impact these things have made. And I'm really grateful that there's so many good researchers and doctors like yourself that are interested in that and are working so hard for it. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Will. It's a pleasure to speak to you again. And yes, we'll have to make this a regular thing. I just greatly appreciate all your support for the importance of thinking about women and aging and how we can improve health and well-being as we all get older. So thank you.
And that was part two of my interview with Dr. Paula Rochon of the Women's Age Lab in Toronto, part of Women's College Hospital. Once again, I'd like to thank her very much for her time. If you'd like more information, you can check out the Women's Age Lab website at the following address, the usual www.womensagelab.ca. And you can also contact them if you have any questions or want some information. Same address, Women's Age Lab, all one word, at wchospital.ca. So women's without the apostrophe, just WOMENS, Age Lab, all one word, at wchospital.ca. While you're on the website, you can download a copy of the toolkit for the Gendered Ageism campaign. And that can help you raise the subject with people at your workplace, your school, or wherever you are in any gatherings where the topic comes up or you might want to bring it up. There's also a brief to healthcare institutions about the prescribing cascades information that we talked about earlier in the interview. And you can get PDFs of both of these for free. You can also get a copy of their impact report for 2022-2023 that you can download. And you can also subscribe to their newsletter so you can get information about all of the endeavors of the Women's Age Lab as they progress in your own email inbox periodically. So there's many ways that you can reach them and hear and read more information about all the important work that they're doing for older women's health. So once again, heartfelt thanks to Dr. Rochon, and I hope that by this time next year there'll be even more progress and even more projects, and we'll have a whole new bunch of information to share with you all. And we're going to continue our show now with some seasonal music, given that this time of year is the intersection of so many major holidays. So we're going to start with another piece from Kay Gardner. This is for the winter solstice. This is a piece from her feminist oratorio called Ouroboros, Seasons of Life, Women's Passages. And it's divided up into 9 segments, starting with the beginning of life and then going through all the different stages of a woman's life. So this piece is called Birth/Winter Solstice, and it is in 3 segments, a choral piece, a musical interlude, and then a closing chant. So here is Birth/Winter Solstice by Kay Gardner. This is for a full symphony orchestra and choir, and this was the inaugural concert conducted by Nan Washburn.
Thank you.
Once again, that was the Birth Winter Solstice segment of Kay Gardner's feminist oratorio, Ouroboros, Seasons of Life, Women's Passages. Okay, being that it is still Hanukkah, I'm going to play a Hanukkah song that was actually composed by Woody Guthrie. The lyrics were, he was married at one point to a Jewish woman, and he collaborated some with her mother, so his mother-in-law, who was an eminent Yiddish poet. And he wrote these lyrics called Happy Joyous Hanukkah. It was set to music by the group The Klezmatics, and we're going to hear a version by the Indigo Girls.
How many nights for Hanukkah? Happy Joyous Hanukkah. Nights and days, days and nights. Happy Joyous Hanukkah. Eight of the nights of Hanukkah. Happy Joyous Hanukkah. Eight of the days and eight of the nights. Happy Joyous Hanukkah. How many candles do I light? Happy Joyous Hanukkah. Eight of the candles you should light. Happy Joyous Hanukkah. So happy Hanukkah. Eat for the new built doctor place. Happy joyous Hanukkah. That shines, happy joyous Hanukkah. Around this whole wide world tonight, happy joyous Hanukkah.
Nine is for God's light that shines,
eight for the new built altar place,
seven for the sons of Hannah that died,
six for the kings and the tricks they tried,
five for the brothers Maccabee,
four for the Hebrew children,
three for the books that Ezra taught,
two for the father and mother love,
and one for the Moses on the mount,
eight of the nights of Hanukkah.
That was the Indigo Girls with Happy Joyous Hanukkah, and I'd like to wish all my Jewish sisters just that, and I hope that you're enjoying all that yummy fried food just like I am. This is pretty much the end of our show, so I have just enough time to wish everybody happy holidays, whatever ones you like to observe, Merry Christmas, bright blessings on solstice, or a wonderful Kwanzaa, or Happy Hanukkah, or just a wonderful couple of weeks off, or 10 days off, whatever you can get. Rest, relax, eat good food, and be with your loved ones. And let's hope that 2024 is going to be a year of greater peace and greater progress towards social justice here and all over the world. My name is Laura Yaris. I've been your host. Once again, Older Women Live. We're here every second Wednesday of the month, so we'll see you on the second Wednesday of January next year. Stay healthy, everyone. We leave you now with a wonderful song related to Kwanzaa by Sweet Honey in the Rock. It's called The Seven Principles.
Umoja,
unity that brings us together.